Today, we're going to do a PowerPoint, as you can see. And the purpose is to discuss something that I think you'll find interesting. And it may be, as you begin, you may wonder where we're going with this. But the title of the presentation is There More to the Story? Is there more to the story? And when I ask their question, is there more to a story, what stories I'm talking about are Bible stories. Bible stories. Bible stories are one of the tools used to teach children. I know that as I grew up, my mom read me Bible stories. We went to Sunday school and we heard Bible stories. We went to vacation Bible school and heard Bible stories. And we in the church use Bible stories to teach our children as well. So it's very much a part of teaching that takes place in a Christian setting, in Christian homes, in Christian churches. And as you look at the subject of Bible stories and you think about them, many of us in this room grew up with Bible stories. But as you look at the generation coming along now, the question is, how many of them are hearing Bible stories and have even an inkling about those stories that we heard as we were children growing up? Many of them don't know who Moses was and that Moses led Israel through the Red Sea. They don't know of Jonah and the whale. In fact, if you bring up Bible stories and mention Bible characters, they may not know who you're talking about at all. And they may ask the question, how are those relevant to me? Now, as you think about this subject, we have some familiar stories like Daniel in the lion's den. We're familiar with the story of Adam and Eve. And all of us would know of those stories. And sometimes, you know, as you read books that are Bible stories to your children, they're portrayed in a rather cartoonish way. I know that I scanned in a picture of a book called The Book of Jonah, and it goes through that particular book. And the picture on the front of the book is a very nicely done art piece by Peter Spire about Jonah being swallowed by the whale. And we're all familiar with that. But as you think about that story, which is famous among Christians, how much of the book of Jonah is involved with that particular part of it? Two sentences. And you have four chapters, and out of that four chapters, you have two sentences, which basically is seen as the primary focus of Jonah and the whale. We'll correct that next week, but this week, I'll just lay that out there. But as you look at how we all grew up with Bible stories. I still remember some of the Bible stories and things that we were told. But the Bible tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 11, something that is important to consider. In 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verse 11, this particular verse applies to Bible stories. It says, "When I was a child, I spoke as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child." So there was a time in our lives when we understood the Bible stories from a child's point of view. And our view was limited because we were children. And then Paul goes on to say, "But when I became a man, I put away childish things." Does that mean that the Bible stories were no longer relevant? That's not what Paul is pointing to. Paul is saying that when you grew up and you became an adult, then you're going to begin to look at Bible stories in a very different way. You're going to look at them as an adult would look at them and dig out the deeper meaning that you find in the stories. So the question is, are Bible stories only relevant to children? In other words, is there more to the story? And as we'll find out, there actually is more to the story. The Bible stories are real stories, and God expected that we would weave these stories into the fabric of our lives. So yes, we may have gone through them for the first time when we were children, but as adults, we've begun to delve more deeply into them, and we've begun to take to heart the messages and the teachings that you find there. and they should be intertwined as part of our lives as Christians, and they're important lessons for each of us, or God would not have put them in the Bible. So yes, we can use them to teach our children, but they should also be things that we continue to take to heart and learn from and be reminded of. So, getting back to the fundamental question, are the stories only for children, or is there more to the story? Now, as you think about that and seek to answer that, is there a place that you could go to in the Scriptures that would tell you that the Bible stories are important and they're more important than just for children? Let's go to a passage that also was written by the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. This particular scripture helps us to answer that question. Are Bible stories just for children? And is there more to the story? 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. And this refers to a famous Bible story as part of it. It says, "Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud." So we probably heard Bible stories of Israel following being led by the cloud. "All passed through the sea." We've seen pictures of the Red Sea being parted and the people of Israel starting through. We've all seen those pictures. And all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And the fact that they were baptized is not a childlike thing. That's an adult action that takes place. "All ate the same spiritual food." And that spiritual food is significant and is a reminder of what took place there as God worked with them. "And all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness." So Paul is citing this story of Israel coming out of Egypt and using it to convey an important message to the Corinthians and thereby to you and me. Verse 6 says, "Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted." So these things, these stories, remind us that we're not to lust as the people anciently lusted, but we're to learn lessons from them. They're examples, they're types. Verse 7, "And do not become idolaters as were some of them. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play." So they sinned against God and suffered the consequences for that. "Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. Nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer." So this whole scenario, beginning with Israel coming out of Egypt, going through the Red Sea, walking through the wilderness, all of those stories related to Israel and its journey to the land of promise are all there for our example. It's there to teach us. Verse 11, "Now all these things happen to them as examples." All of these things happen to them as examples. And God made sure that these things were recorded for us. They happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. So the passage that we've read, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 1 through verse 12, tells us clearly that Bible stories are not just for children. They're for you and me. They're for God's people. And they serve a very great purpose, or God would not have put them in the Scriptures. Now, as we went through that passage, what is the most important verse in that passage? Well, it is in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 11. And we read, now all these things that Paul is citing, all these things happened to them as examples. And they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So let's look, focus to begin with on the word admonition. What does admonition mean? What does admonition mean? Most of us associate that word with correction or warning. You know, we are given admonition by our parents or friends or employers or whatever it may be. We're given admonitions and we see them as maybe corrective or giving us a warning. Also, it's a word that conveys power and conveys seriousness. It's a serious word. You know, and so as you hear admonition, it's something we need to take heed of because it may impact our lives significantly. So he said they were given for our admonition. So he's telling you, you need to pay attention to these things and their significance and how they apply to you. And admonish actually covers the entire range of human instruction, from encouragement to rebuke. So you're encouraging and you may be rebuking in the sense that you're telling them not to do something and pointing that finger at them and telling them they need to straighten up and fly right. So it covers a whole span from encouragement to correction. And as you look at admonition, it's interesting to look at the Greek words, the Greek words, and look at the meaning. There are two words that are translated admonition in the Scriptures. One of them is nuthesia, and it literally means a putting in mind. It's something that puts something in your mind, brings it to your mind. And it's the word that is used in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11. And the purpose of the Scriptures, it is given to us there in nuthesia. It refers to the training of the training by the Word. Training by the Word. So you read the words and drink in of what those words say, and you become trained by it. And it, as we've seen, it could be encouragement or it could be reproof, correction. The other word that's used that is synonymous with it is paideia, and it refers to training by action. As you, those of you who went to college, you may remember back to there were certain courses that you took when you were in college, and you had a lecture portion of the class, and you also had a lab. So they would lecture, give you a lecture and tell you certain things, and then you would go put that, what you've learned, into practice. So, for instance, you go to chemistry class and they talk about chemistry and certain facets of it and introduce certain definitions and things, and then, okay, it's lab, we're going to do chemical work and we're going to work on bases and acids and different things and see how they interact. So the lab helps you to put into practice some of those things that you learned in the lecture portion of the class. So in the language of the New Testament, admonition dealt with the training of the mind through words. The training of the mind through words. So when Paul said, all of these things happened for examples, and they were written for our admonition, he was saying they are there to train our minds by the use of words. Now, as you think about this further, are there any Bible stories that come to mind that your mind has been trained by? You've read the story, you remember the story impacted you, and your mind has begun to be trained by it. The question might be something to think about. Are there any stories that you find in the Bible that we would feel like, you know, this is an important story and it's been a guide to me in how I've lived? To help in thinking about this subject, I'd like to consider a story that has relevance to me as a minister and as a parent. And because you see a situation here where the instruction is very helpful to a teacher or a parent. And the story we're going to look at gives us insight into dealing with the immature or dealing with the dysfunctional. And when I use the word dysfunctional, I'm using it in a broad context. It's a broad category, and one tend to which most of us, for one reason or another, fall into. But here's the story. You see this picture. Do you remember what that's about? Who's being talked about here? We obviously know. And this is found in Genesis chapter 4. And I'll just read the passage. And beginning in Genesis chapter 4, verse 1. Now Adam and Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, and said, I have acquired a man from the Lord. Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So those were their occupations. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord. And Abel also brought the firstborn of his flock and of their fat. And the Lord respected Abel and his offering. So as you look at that particular incident, was it just luck that Abel brought the offering that God approved of? It was just luck. He just, well, I've got sheep, so I'm going to bring a sheep. Is that what it was? It was just a matter of luck. And Cain, he didn't know any better. He just chose to bring what he produced from his garden. It wasn't a matter of luck. It was a matter of one son choosing to hear God and heed what he said, and the other son choosing to do what he wanted to do. So you can already see by the fact that God accepted one and not the other, things are off the rails here already. And we see more about how it's off the rails as we go through. It says here, it says that, verse 5, but he did not respect, that is, God did not respect Cain and his offering. And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. So, as you look at that, it's a simple, seven-scripture-long story. There's not much to it. It's pretty simple, but there is more to the story when you step back and look at it. Now, we've talked about dysfunction, and as I said, we're using this in a broad sense, and as I said, we all cease to function effectively from time to time. All of us are dysfunctional in some way, shape, or form. All of us are. The worst case scenarios in regard to dysfunction are those who have grown up in a difficult background. They've been abused, they've been used, and during their growing up years, and those negatives have impacted them in such a way it makes functioning difficult for them. And it doesn't matter how we were brought up, every one of us at some point in time is incapable of functioning. We have difficulty functioning in certain situations. In other words, we are dysfunctional at that point. But Cain, in this particular situation we see here in chapter 4, was not functioning. He brought an offering. God did not accept his offering. And as I said, if he had brought the offering that was pleasing to God, would he have been accepted? Absolutely. It wasn't God was against Cain. It was a matter of Cain was not respecting God in the offering that he brought. Abel brought an offering which God accepted, and Abel was not just lucky, as I said. He knew what to bring, and he did what God told him to do. But how did Cain react? He was furious. Cain was furious. It was an attitude that God addressed. So Cain had grown up in a household where he was the golden child. He could do no wrong. And he expected adulation all the time, and we can get into this more fully, but we're not going to go there. We've got other things to talk about. But that's where he came from. And to be rejected and not be the premier child, oh, that was a devastating blow to him. So he was terribly angry at his brother. So as you look at what's played out here in chapter 4, you see that God has a methodology. God has a methodology in the way that he deals with Cain. And he begins with encouragement. He doesn't accuse. He doesn't accuse. He began with a question. And he is laying things out for Cain. And he says in Genesis chapter 4, verse 6, he asks the question. He said to Cain, "Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen?" Why? He asked him the question, why? Why is it that you're angry? Why is it that your countenance has fallen? How many of you who've interacted with other people, as you've told them what they don't want to hear, have noticed their countenance fall? If you've raised children, you see their countenance fall. If you're a teacher, you see their countenance fall. Probably, my son, I always remember his countenance would fall, and the way I looked at it was the death blow. It just killed him. And you could just see it in his behavior and his countenance. It definitely fell, and he was very unhappy, and you knew it. And if you've raised children, you've experienced that. You've seen their countenance fall. But God's asking him a question. Why? Why has your countenance fallen? And as you see, the way God works with Cain here, it's a way that we can work with other people. We can work with them as a minister. We can work with them as a parent. We can work with them and go forward in dealing with the situation in a positive way. So God, as I said, began with a question. He didn't begin as an authoritarian because he saw that the countenance had fallen. He saw that he was angry. He could have chewed him out. "Your attitude is terrible. How can you act like this?" He could have chewed him out. He could have said, "You need to straighten up and fly right." But that's not what he did. He asked him a question. Why are you angry? And why has your countenance fallen? So God begins this way because it's the approach that he knows has the greatest chance of reaching Cain and helping Cain to move forward in a positive way. So he's asking Cain, why? He wants Cain to look at himself and reflect on why he's in this particular state. And he didn't chew him out. He was trying to help this individual who is a potential son of God and had anger issues. And he could see that the anger was all over his face. He said, "I can see it. So tell me why." Because he wants Cain to begin to deal with his problem. So then God moves on to encouragement. God moves on to encouragement. And how does he encourage Cain? He says, "If you do well, will you not be received? If you do well, will you not be received?" And what is God telling Cain in that statement? He's saying, "I'm not your enemy. I'm not against you. I'm not going to retaliate. You're angry, but I'm not going to retaliate against you. I want you to recognize your problem. I want you to take ownership of it and change." God was on his side. God was on Cain's side. And I'm here as a supporter, and I want you to successfully deal with this and move in a positive direction. And you know, as you look at that, God, that's how God is when he deals with you and me. And it's how we can deal with others. As we recognize that they're angry, we can take this approach. And then going on with God's methodology, God explained the consequences. I mean, you got to tell them there is an outcome to this if you don't change. Genesis chapter 4, verse 7 says, "If you do not do well, sin lies at the door." Anger and your fallen countenance is leading to sin. He says, "Sin lies at the door and its desire is for you." Sin basically is a force that wants to rule and dominate you. It wants you to give in to it. And you have a choice. You have a choice. And God is telling him, if you don't deal with your problem is ultimately going to deal with you. So how does God end the conversation here? What's the last part of his methodology? In Genesis chapter 4, verse 7, it says, but you should rule over it. You should rule over it. Don't let sin, don't let evil of any kind rule over you. And as you look at this passage, this seven-verse passage, there's a lot of teaching in a very small space. There's a lot there if you're willing to look at it and take it to heart. What we could all do is take this to heart, and as we see somebody's countenance fall, why not start with a question? For me as a parent, that wasn't my methodology. My methodology was, look, you need to get your act together and knock this off. And that didn't work all the time, most of the time. But I was unaware of it at the time. But you know, where is this found? It's found in the fourth chapter of the book of Genesis. So it's right at the beginning if you're willing to look at it. But we can tend to look at something that we consider a Bible story, and we don't pay any attention to the details. But God tells us that there's more to the story. And you can see it just by looking at chapter 4, verses 1 through 7. As you think about the modern classroom, what happens in the modern classroom today? When I was going to school back in ancient times, if you were out of line, you got to visit with the principal. So you're heading down to the principal, and depending upon the infraction, you got detention, or you may have gotten a SWAT. So I remember my brother let the air out of the tires of this trailer on the playground, and that was noted by the assistant principal, so he got to visit with him, and he did get a SWAT for that. And they got to pump up the tire. So anyway, I don't know whether he let the air out of the tire, but when he was in fourth grade, that seemed like a good thing to do. And so at one time, you had corporal punishment, but in today's schoolrooms, you cannot punish children corporally. There is no corporal punishment. So what does that mean in dealing with children? It means that you don't have physical force to enforce something. That means you have to be more creative in the way that you approach the children in order to get the positive outcome that you want. So to encourage the children and yet to have boundaries, and an integral part of moving somebody from that dysfunctional position Cain was in, to move them to someone who would take ownership of their attitudes and understand they are not beset by enemies, that you, in bringing the matter up to them, are not their enemy, that you're for them. You want them to get their act together. I can't spank you, but I can give you some form of punishment, because the goal is for you to move forward. I want you to move forward. And to honestly believe the person offering the admonishment is there to help them be successful. They know you're on their side. You want the best for them. From a ministerial perspective, you can't find any better training than you find in Genesis chapter 4. So let's look at the word we've gone through, that admonish. To be trained by the use of words, but how? So we are to be trained by use of words. That's what the word in the Greek means. That's what admonishment means. So under the header of admonish, or to be trained by the use of words, to train our minds, how is that done? How is that done? So let's take that how a little further and go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. It says, and the question is, in what way do these stories train our minds? In what way do these stories train our minds? Think about how the verse, 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, began. It says, now these things happened to them as examples. They happened to them as examples. And it is incorrect to think that everything in the Bible was put there so that they could write stories about them. So that we could look at them later. The Bible was not written, let's write down some stories in order to instruct people. What you had happening with Cain and Abel, you had two real people. Two real people in a real situation that they had to make decisions about. One chose wisely, the other one didn't. And so God recorded that so that we could learn bad choice, good choice, how do you move forward? So God recorded that for us. They were living people with the problems common to men and women and problems that they had to conquer. And we're human and we have problems and we have to conquer those problems. As Mr. Braley was talking about, we have to overcome. You have to conquer them. So God recorded what they had to acknowledge and deal with themselves. And the scenarios recorded had value beyond themselves. And as you look at the Greek in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, where it says they were examples, the word is actually type. They were types, T-Y-P-E-S. Now, I mentioned the word type, and you're probably thinking, what's a type? What does that mean? Well, let me give you some other options that may help you to understand. Another word for type is a pattern. Another word for type is model. Another word for type is illustration. For example, when you don't know how to do something, where do you go to get the answer? I'm not talking about church. I'm talking about, let's say, you need to fix something at your house. I know that I was talking to one member, and he said that he had to do something on his car, and he looked at YouTube, and bam-o, there it was, his make, his model, the PC needed. And I know that, you know, I didn't know exactly how to get the blinds, you know, we have blinds, and how to get the blinds down. So I went to YouTube, I saw that I have to put a screwdriver in there and pull this little piece out, and then I can pull them out completely. And I did it without injury. So that's always a good accomplishment. But you look at YouTube, and I know that I needed to change the blade on my mower, and so I found the perfect tool and got the job done. So YouTube offers us all sorts of patterns and types that we can look to as to how to solve various problems. My garbage disposal wouldn't work, so I know that if you put a Allen wrench in there and kind of twist it, that it'll break it loose. And bam-o, it's working. So we didn't have to buy a new garbage disposal, and there's YouTube. So how did we function without YouTube? I mean, it's a miracle that we got this far, you know. But that's how it is. And so it's a wonderful tool. And God has given us a tool in giving us these stories that we can look at, because they're like YouTube videos that show us, how do I deal with this? What do I do in this situation? And they give us wonderful information to help us in seeing how to live. Barnes, in his notes, makes a comment about types. He comments on verse 11 of 1 Corinthians 10. And he says, this isn't the whole quote, but part of it, the sense is that these things took place simply and solely to be examples or admonitions, but that their occurrence illustrated great principles of human nature. What we see in the scriptures tells us about human nature. We as human beings have a nature, and that nature is the same from Genesis to Revelation. It doesn't change. It's been consistent. So it gives us great principles of human nature and of the divine government. So the stories that we look at, such as the story of Cain, we see human nature in action, and we see how God dealt with it, God's government in action. And the more we study history, the more we're aware of the fact that ages pass, societies come and go. But man thinks the same. Man thinks the same. At all times and faces the same mental, emotional, and spiritual struggles. And, you know, I'm 67 years old and it's just dawning on me that, you know, I see all of the outrageous things that are done in the political world. But in reading a particular book about Alexander Hamilton, it became very clear they were no different back in Alexander the Hamilton's time. They were vicious, cruel, liars, cheats, doing all sorts of terrible things. And they've been doing that for 6,000 years. It's just human nature. It's the way we are. So the patterns are ageless. The stories we find in the Bible are ageless. They apply at any age. And we can look to them for how to deal with them. One of the most famous stories we find in the Bible is David and Goliath. I think every one of us has, if we've had children, we've read that story to our kids. And, you know, as little boys looking at this story of this young man taking on this giant, you know, from a young man's point of view, that's an exciting story. Here's this teenager named David taking on a giant, taking on this man that was 9 foot tall, taking on this man who could carry armor that weighed between 80 and 160 pounds. He wasn't hindered by that at all. I mean, it was amazing to me to learn that soldiers in World War II, they had an 80-pound pack. He had an 80-pound pack and he had to hump that baby all over the place. Now, some of that stuff, you may have had 80 on day one, but as time went along, that the amount of stuff in that pack diminished until you were down to what you just needed. And you traveled a little bit lighter. But they were able to do it. I mean, when you look at his spearhead was 2 to 2.5 inches in diameter. You know, if that thing plunged into you, you weren't going to survive. And he had a very long shaft on that as a 9-foot man. So the head of the spear weighed about 17 pounds. And this was a man who had been trained as a warrior from his youth. He was a skilled warrior. He had killed many men. And, you know, for a young boy looking at that story, it's pretty fascinating. And you look at the next picture, you can see the difference in height. It says David was 5'8". Maybe. It doesn't give us his height. But he was, you know, 4 foot or so less than Goliath. Now, I would be a little intimidated by that, wouldn't you? You know, when I play basketball and I'm going in for a layup and there's a 9-foot guy there, I know what's going to happen. I'm going to have to be awfully agile to get that ball in the hoop without him swatting it away. So every day as David came into the camp, what was happening? You have the two armies on either side of a valley with a creek or a brook running down through the middle of it. They're both there arrayed on the two hillsides. And out from the Philistine group comes Goliath. And he challenges the Israelites. He says, send somebody out. I'll fight anybody you want to send out here. He was a confident man. He knew, whoever you send out, I'm going to kill him. I will kill him. And this was a situation in the world where you could still have a combat between two individuals, and it would allow nobody else to get involved in the conflict. They would take care of it, and everybody would abide by the winner. The people that lost, they would be the slaves or servants of the other people. So that's how it worked. And day after day, he went to challenge the people of Israel, the cowards of Israel, and nobody was going to do it. Nobody was going to go out there and fight this man. And David happened to be coming into the camp when he heard Goliath challenging Israel and basically blaspheming God. And David was offended by what was taking place there. He was offended by this man who challenged Israel and the great God of Israel. And so David is outraged, and he basically said, I will go and deal with Goliath. And David said, I worship a God who will not allow this man to continue to badmouth the God of Israel. So this was faith, and Goliath had confidence in himself. He knew he was going to win. Had no doubt, and the Philistines felt the same way. And what were David's credentials? So David talked to somebody in the camp of Israel, and they let Saul know about David, and David went to Saul, and Saul asked him, what are your credentials to go take this guy on? And so what does David tell him? He said, I, your servant, used to keep his father's sheep. So if this guy's going to go out and represent you, and he tells you that his main qualification is the fact that he was a shepherd, is that going to inspire confidence for you? Now, usually we think of shepherds in with the flock, and they're out in the fields, and it's beautiful, and it's very pleasant out there, and what a wonderful job. But your job was to protect the sheep. And what happens is when you have sheep out in the country, there are predators that figure out, hey, these sheep are good to eat, and there are a lot of them. I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity. For instance, this week, I shouldn't have, but I bought a donut and took my daughter to get a donut, or granddaughter to get a donut. So she got a donut, I got a donut for my grandson, and I snuck in a donut too. So when I got home, there was kind of chaos going on, and I heard the dog barking. I thought, why is he barking? I thought he had gotten outside. And when I got into my office, there he was with the last remnants of my donut. And basically, dogs are going to eat whatever's available. And they have no moral compunction to eating your donut. Okay? So he ate my donut, and really that was better for my blood sugar. But anyway, he had to deal with this. Predators coming to take the sheep. They were his father's sheep. He was a responsible shepherd. And he took them on. And he told them. He goes on to say, when he talks about watching his father's sheep, he said, when a lion or bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, then I had to deal with it. He had to take on a lion. He had to take on a bear. And that's no mean feat. But it was something that he had experienced. And so as he came into the camp and he said, I will fight with this giant. I have no problem doing that. Why was he able to do it? Because he had experienced what it means to face formidable adversaries. I faced a lion. I faced a bear. And I killed them both. I vanquished them both and I saved the sheep. And this giant, he's no different than that bear or that lion. God was with me then and God will be with me now. So I don't have to worry about it. God will see me through in this situation. So he goes out to fight the giant, and he picks up 5 stones in the brook. Now, why did he pick up 5 smooth stones in the brook? If you have ever had a sling and have used it, you know, you don't want some wobbly stone. You want a stone that's going to fly straight and true. And those smooth stones that would be smoothed out by being in the brook are the perfect stones for that. And he picked up 5 of them. He picked up 5 of them. And what he did is, he didn't wait for Goliath to come for him. He went toward Goliath. Because the fact that he had to walk down that hill to the brook, bend down and pick up those stones, meant he was advancing toward Goliath. And once he got the stones, he got set and he began up the hill, moving toward Goliath. And so he picked up what he needed. And as you look at David and his skill with the sling, many of us have never grown up with slings. We didn't do that. I had a slingshot, but never a sling with the you know, swinging it around your head. I figured I'd hit myself in the head, and I didn't want to go there. But David was not far that far removed from the period of the judges. And there was a in Judges chapter 20, it talks about in the city of Gibeah that you had these Benjamites who were skilled slingers. In Judges 20, verse 16, it said, among all this people were 700 select men who were left-handed, and everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. So they could sling it at something pretty small, and they could hit what they were aiming at. They were skilled. And David was a skilled individual as well. Greek historians noted that on the island of Majorca, there was an entire society of slingers. And in that society, they started training the children in their youth. And what they would do is they would put the children's food on this pole. And if the children wanted the food, they had to knock it off the pole. If you don't hit the food, you're going to go hungry. So develop your skills with the sling. And so they were very skilled with the sling, and they could actually sling a stone about 600 feet, which is the length of 2 football fields. So just imagine looking across the football field, the length of it, 2 lengths, and they could hit something that far away. So that tells you the skill and power that they were able to exert in doing that. So David went out, and he killed Goliath. And what we see here is that David killing Goliath is not a fairy tale. It wasn't magic. It wasn't something magical that took place. David had developed the skill and the courage to go take on the giant, and he knew that with God's help and guidance, he could do it. It's a story that's a part of Christian living. Because every one of us faces giants, don't we? They may not be a 9-foot-tall man, but they are giants. And God's not going to carry us. God's not going to do it all for us. We've got to do everything we possibly can do. And God wants us to see us put everything into it that we have the capacity to put into it. And then God says, I'll make up the difference. I'll make up the difference. So, as David went out, he took on the giant and defeated him, and it's there for you and me. God put it there so that we could look at it and be confident, that we could see that pattern, that illustration. Look at what David did. And it's meant to encourage us what we could do as well. So, let's go to 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11 once again. Now, we've looked at two key aspects of this particular verse. We've looked at now all these things happen to us as examples, types, patterns, and they were written for our admonition that we might be trained by the words that we read. And then it talks about that these things happen to them as examples upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So these were written to be especially helpful to those who are living at the end of the age, the time in which we now live. So what are the types, patterns, and illustration? Why are they more impactful now or more relevant now than they were, let's say, 500 years ago? Maybe even 75 years ago. Why is that? Paul explains that to us in 2 Timothy chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. And we're just going to look at verse 1. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. It's talking about the end of the age. And it says there in verse 1, but know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. Stressful times. Times filled with peril. They're coming as we come to the end of the age. And these examples are especially helpful to us at that time. And times have become more stressful in the present age. And why is that? Why have times become more stressful? The bottom line is sin is more commonplace. It's more commonplace. And as sin becomes more common, the people of God are challenged and stressed. We're challenged and stressed. And one reason it's more stressful is because we as God's people, desire to be right with God. That's been the condition found in every generation of God's people. They wanted to be right with God. And the more complicated the times become, it's a challenge to determine the conduct that God wants in a situation. By being admonished, by learning and applying the types and illustrations and patterns, we discern when a particular pattern is relative to whatever we face. There are different things that come along in life that we have to deal with, and we need wisdom to know what applies where. The greatest stressor for a Christian is identifying right and wrong. And we need patterns to follow more than any people who have ever lived. What is right and wrong? Has that become blurred in our time? It most assuredly has. It's not as clearly defined as it once was. And as you think about the current world we live in, the world that we live in is governed by exception. The exception to the rule. It's the blurring of lines in right and wrong. A society that makes its judgments on situations and conditions. Well, it's situational ethics, you know. I've got to do this. It's wrong, but it's okay to do this now because of this situation. It makes establishing what is wrong, right and wrong, all the more difficult. And it actually causes the society to erode. It can cause us to erode from God's high standard. So, it is easy, as resolution is eroded, to govern by exception. To govern by exception. Which is to say, this is a challenging situation, but in this case, I'll make an exception. For instance, we know we shouldn't lie. But the situation is such that if I tell the truth, I'm going to be fired. I'm going to lose my job, and I have a family. I can't let my family down. So it's okay to lie. Now, I'm going to go off the rails here just this once, but I'll get back on the rails and fly along on the straight and narrow. And that's what I mean by governing by exception. Let's look at a Bible story we're familiar with in regard to a man who would not compromise, a man who would not live by exception. And this man is Daniel. Now, when you look at the picture, somebody may point this out later, but you notice what's on the plate. It looks like, to me, a Cornish hen or something like that. But as far as I know, those are clean. Okay, chickens are clean. So I don't know what that's all about. They may not have known about clean and unclean meat, but I thought it was kind of a neat picture. And you notice he very clearly says, no, I'm not going to take what you have on the platter. And there may be other reasons why he rejected that. So as you look at Daniel, Daniel was handpicked out of thousands of Jews. A Jewish young man who was being given the opportunity of a lifetime to be able to be trained in the culture, the language, and the things that were important to the governance of Babylon. He was going to be a government official. It was a very high position in the kingdom of Babylon. And it's interesting that the story of Daniel starts out with Daniel saying, I'm not eating off the king's table. And you may think about, what's wrong with him? Just eat off the king's table. You've only got to put in 3 years and then you can go back to normal. But you're going to quibble over this really small matter? Why even get involved in that? But Daniel said, sorry, I'm not going to compromise. Not even a little bit. I can't eat that. I won't eat that because it is that you had unclean things, you had things that had been sacrificed to idols, they were sacrificed to the idol, part of it went to the king and the other part went to the people in this program. And he says, I know that, I can't eat that. You also had meat that was not rightly bled, you had meat that was animals that were strangled. He wasn't going to eat those things. He says, I'm not eating that. And he tells the steward that, and the steward is thinking, what's wrong with you? If you don't look good when I bring you to the king, he's going to lop my head off. So he'll lop your head off and my head, and I don't want to go there. But Daniel convinced him that everything would be fine, and it turned out to be that case. And you see, Daniel would not allow himself to be ruled by exception. He would not allow himself to be ruled by exception. And Jameson Fawcett Brown is the next slide, and I already talked about the things that were unacceptable with the food. It wasn't just it might have been unclean. There were some other issues that may have prevailed there as well. So Daniel had no situational ethics, and he did not govern himself by exception. He was going to adhere to the truth regardless of the price he had to pay. Now, the final point, let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 12. It says, therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. And then it says, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. So what does this have to do with Bible stories and the subject that we're talking about? It says, it basically saying, look, you have read the Bible story, you've looked at the lesson there, and some people, just because they've become adults, Bible stories have no meaning to them anymore, no longer relevant. Why even pay attention to that? I'm an adult, why am I going to look at that baby stuff? And he's saying, you know, if you're going to take that position and act in that particular way, you think you stand. You think you're on good, solid ground. In fact, you're going to fall. You're going to fall. You think that there's nothing for me to learn in these Bible stories. They're for little kids. As we've seen, there's a lot for us to learn from those Bible stories. And we should never come to the point where these things don't no longer apply to us. They always do. And then he says, the things that you face in your life, you know, giants, things that come your way that are challenging, they're things that have happened to people throughout the ages. You're not unique. God's people throughout the ages have faced these very same things. Their experience and their action has been laid out for you and me. So he says, take to heart those things that you read in those stories. Take to heart those stories of Joseph and the other patriarchs. Take to heart those things because there are lessons there for us. Don't just gloss over it. Don't say, well, I know that story. Look at the story a little bit closer so that you can be trained by the words. Let's go to another passage that impacts Bible stories, dealing with Bible stories. This is in Romans chapter 15, verse 4. Romans 15, verse 4. It says, for whatever things were written before were written for our learning. God wrote these things down so that we could learn, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope. And it says, whatever. And whatever is all-inclusive. It includes everything. It's not some small number of things, but it's everything. And it says, whatever stories there are have the ability to do something constructive in our lives. They have the ability to give us comfort. They have the ability to give us hope. And they give us the ability to be patient. To be patient. So what does a Bible story have to do in order to impact these things in our lives? To help to alter patience and comfort and hope. That's why God put those things in there, is to give us comfort, to give us hope, to give us patience. At times, as Christians, and I've experienced this as a minister over the years, at times, there are people that feel very lonely, they're struggling against sin, and they're not making any progress. And they see the sins repeated in their lives, and they come to think that my baptism was not valid. My baptism was not valid. And so they're struggling. And so they have that feeling, that negative view of things. And one minister explained how he dealt with that. And what did he say? He says to them, as he looks at their baptism, he says, "Who was the last member of the church that you killed?" Who was the last member of the church that you killed? Who was the last member of the church that you tortured to the point where they blasphemed the name of God? How many of you have been involved in such a thing? I don't think anybody here. Final question is, who is the last member of the church you imprisoned? I don't think any of us have done any of those things. And yet, look at the person who did. Let's go to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 9. There it says, "For I am the least of the apostles." He had sinned. He had sinned egregiously. And he accepted that he had. And he accepted that through Jesus Christ his sins had been forgiven. He said, "For I am the least of the apostles, who am not worthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church." I was an enemy of the church. I hunted down the people of God. I imprisoned them. I killed them. I tortured them. And I thought that I was in God's service. And I came to find out that I wasn't. He repented. And God forgave him of those transgressions. So as we look at what we've done, and we have sinned, and we must acknowledge them and repent of them. But as you look at Paul, Paul went far beyond what we have in most cases. One of the patterns the Bible provides for us is that no matter how low we feel and how unworthy we feel, we are not anywhere near the back of the line. We're not anywhere near the back of the line. We're still in line, and God is still working with us, and that should be comforting. When you see people who faced problems similar to yours, and the Bible story shows at the completion of it that they were triumphant, and you say, "I've just seen my life played out in front of me in the pages of the Bible, and I've seen the conclusion. I see the conclusion. They made it. And because I can look back and be comforted, and have hope because of their experience, I can make it too. I can make it too." As you look at human beings are geared and wired to believe that if they see a Bible character facing something they are facing, they can relate. Seeing their success leads us as human beings that we can be successful too. That we can have hope. And as you look at people who are hopeless, they basically reach the point where they see that God and His plan are unobtainable. I can never obtain it. They see that I can't get there. It's never going to happen. And they give up. They have no hope. But God says, as you look at the patterns, you look at the illustrations, you look at the examples, you should have hope. Because those examples are there in order to give you hope and to encourage you to move forward and succeed. And we can do so with patience. Because we know that if we stay with it, we will ultimately be victorious. We can overcome anything. We can suffer any stress and difficulty. We can patiently endure. So again, we look at Romans 15, verse 4, and it says, "For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we, through the patience and comfort of the Scriptures, might have hope." So we look at the Scriptures, we're trained by them, we're encouraged by them, we're comforted by them. These are real stories, real people that ultimately are going to be in God's family. They made it. And they face the same things you and I do. So, when you look at Bible stories, is there any value to them? Are they just for children? Or are they for us as the children of God as well? They're for us as the children of God as well. But as the children of God, we can see that we never outgrow our need for Bible stories. So I hope that as you look at a story in the Bible and your Bible reading and study, that you will note that there's more to this story than just a little kid's story. It's a story that has a lot of meaning and significance for me as a potential son of God. So hopefully you can have. So if somebody says Bible stories have no value, you can say, "Let's talk." And you can show them some scriptures that will help to answer that. So I hope you found the sermon of value. Please have a wonderful remainder of the day. Stay warm, and we'll see you all next week.